Down south, they say it's the economy, stupid. Up here, we say it's the economy, eh? And this is Political Economy Radio, a progressive take on economic issues in Canada and beyond. My name is Michał Rozwodski, and welcome to the show. Today, I'm happy to present a feature interview with Doug Henwood, whose excellent Behind the News radio show inspired this podcast. Doug is a longtime economics commentator. He's been publishing the Left Business Observer since the 1980s. He's the author of books including Wall Street and After the New Economy, and of course, host of Behind the News. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Doug on the political economy of the U.S. today. Maybe I'll start with a very broad question. Basically, what's going on with the U.S. economy? We've been hearing that you're in recovery for some time, but clearly this hasn't touched everyone. Stocks are up, average incomes are still stagnant. What's the overall state of the U.S. at present, and who has come out on top since the last crisis?
Well, it's just sort of stumbling along. There's been a recovery. It's been weak by most conventional measures. Growth is weak, GDP growth, conventional measures. Employment growth is very weak, but that really is mostly a function of weak GDP growth. There's really been no breakdown in the relationship between GDP growth and employment growth. It's just that growth overall is quite sluggish, and employment growth is sluggish as a result as well. There's been a pretty decent fall in the unemployment rate, but that is partly because of people just dropping out of the labor force. The share of the adult population that's employed is really at or slightly below even the levels it was at in the just before the Great Recession hit. And as you pointed out, that household incomes are quite weak. The upper classes have done very well, and by that I mean, depending upon who you listen to, the top 3% or the top 1%. But the broad mass of the population, and by that I even mean the upper middle class, is really not done very well. I mean, they're certainly better off than they were in the midst of the crisis 2009, 2010. But it's the worst economic expansion in modern times, meaning one that we have good numbers for. And it still feels that way. To a lot of people, we're still in recession or something like it. I think it's just a very standard post-financial crisis, weak stumbling recovery, and these things take years to get over. And there are also some very serious structural issues to deal with. So we're not really talking about them. We're dealing with them. So it's certainly better than things you're doing in Southern Europe, but not good at all.
Yeah. I want to get to a bunch of points there. Actually, interesting that you mentioned Southern Europe right at the end there, because as we know, the language of austerity has been ubiquitous since this crisis, and that's especially been the case in Europe, cuts to budget, privatization, wage repression, all of this and more. The U.S., on the other hand, though, I mean, you saw some short-lived, relatively significant fiscal stimulus, but short-lived initially, and now the Fed's been since then doing, all this quantitative easing, buying up assets, pumping liquidity, so sort of some kind of monetary stimulation. Has the U.S. avoided austerity, or is there more to this picture? And what's been the meaning of this sort of continued monetary looseness for people?
Austerity compared to less austere compared to Europe, for sure. But state and local governments have been cutting spending and laying off workers. So if you put the overall government sector all together, including all levels of government, it's actually been mildly contractionary since about 2010-2011. We did have a large federal stimulus, but even that was partly offset by state and local government austerity. So we haven't seen anything like what we saw, we've seen it in Greece or Spain or Ireland for in terms of austerity, but it's certainly not been expansive either. And though it must be said that the Federal Reserve has been extremely aggressive in its expansionary policies. It just is ending its purchase of government bonds and mortgage bonds, but it's bought trillions of dollars worth of those things. The idea was to push down long-term interest rates and hope this would stimulate investment and spending. It hasn't by much. It certainly probably has helped a little bit, but most of that liquidity seems to have gone into the financial markets and not into broad wage gains, broad income gains at all. It's really, I think the Fed has been trying, and within their limits of their legal remit, but also their worldview, they've been doing the most they can. But certainly that kind of monetary stimulus has very limited effects, and it's not distributed very evenly.
Right, and you talked about the state and the local level cuts, and I want to ask you, because I've seen you write about this, the big federal policy change, or in terms of social policy, one of the big changes, Obamacare, which is, you know, taken a long time to finally roll out. It's out there. What is the lesson that can be drawn from this, you know, supposed sort of expansion of healthcare and state programs? You know, is this the welfare state with neoliberal characteristics, or neoliberalism with welfare state characteristics?
It's how neoliberals do with the welfare state, I guess. I mean, they created a market ex nihilo. That's sort of the cornerstone of neoliberal thinking, neoliberal social policy. There are some slightly redistributive effects to the expansion of Medicaid, which is the way of poor people or people close to the official poverty line have been brought into Obamacare. Although that's, I think, about half the states are not participating in that. They're mostly very conservative states that just don't like the idea of spending money on poor people. Even though the federal government is paying all of the bill for the first years and almost all of it thereafter, they just don't want to spend anything on expanding coverage for poor folks. But for people in the middle and even upper brackets, it's a different story. They've been either forced by private insurance if they didn't have it at work, or the plans they have are being recast to fit into the Obamacare model. The best kinds of healthcare plans, those that have been enjoyed by government workers, unionized workers in allied industries, academics, you know, people with pretty good jobs, the professional managerial class, they are now condemned as the beneficiaries of something called Cadillac plans, and they're going to be taxed essentially out of existence over the next several years. So the very idea is that people should start paying more for healthcare. So if you have a very good health insurance plan right now, you're not going to have it for much longer because you're not paying enough. You don't have a sense of how expensive healthcare is, and you have to be made to feel it. And that's the way you're going to cut down on usage. This is the cost control component of Obamacare. It's all about making consumers pay more. And we know that this is not going to work out well. We know that people postpone necessary care. There aren't that many people who go to the doctor for the hell of it. So the whole thing is conceptually screwed, but that is really what's going to be the experience of people with good health care plans now. And those who've been buying health care on their own through the exchanges probably don't even understand how bad some of the things that they're buying really are. There are plans that will pay only 60 or 70% of your medical bills. There are plans where you have to going to pay $6,000 out of pocket before you get any insurance benefit at all. And there are often large co-payments, co-insurance, and people could just be spending thousands and thousands of dollars, and the insurance is not going to help them all that much. And there are a bunch of sort of center-right Democrats who are actually pushing an even worse level of coverage, which will only cover about half of your expenses with very, very large deductibles. You know, you have to pay $9,000 on your own before you get any insurance at all. So it's really, except for the expansion of Medicaid for the poorest people, it's really not very redistributive, and it's not going to be greeted with a great deal of enthusiasm, especially if people start using their plans and find out how expensive they turn out to be.
Right, a kind of rationing on the backs of people who don't yet realize it.
And there will still be 30 million uninsured even after the thing takes full effect. So it's not even universal.
I want to switch tracks maybe a little bit, go back to, again, your first response. You've written a lot about elites in the U.S. In the course of your writing. I want to get to your most recent Hillary Clinton piece in a minute. But first I wanted to ask you about economic and financial elites, which I think you know quite a bit about. It seems that recently some of these elites have taken up the cause of inequality. You know, there's billionaires telling others in the 1% to change their ways. I don't know, I heard something about pitchforks. There's IMF reports about the damage inequality does to growth, rating agencies making similar points. Is this a genuine concern on their part, or just cynical posturing, or something more? And more generally, what is the outlook of the elites today?
I think there's a small subset of the elite that's concerned either for reasons of economic sustainability. One of the problems with this weak recovery is that we've historically, for the last several decades, have been compensating for weak income growth by very aggressive borrowing. That outlet got shut down with the 2008 crisis, and so household expenditures are really constrained by very weak income growth. So, they're concerned about that macroeconomic aspect of it. There are some who are concerned about long-term political stability, but I think in general, and I think there are some who are generally concerned about the plight of people who are less well-off. And they are, not to the point of wanting to give up their fortunes, but at least to the point of expressing concern about it. But I think most, the American elite now is, I think, mostly a very rotten thing, comprised of people who really care about only about getting as much money for themselves in as short a period of time as they can. And we even see, at the corporate level, U.S. corporations are just utterly flush with cash. They've just got their balance sheets are bursting with cash. The only thing they've been spending it on is buying their own stock or finding other ways of distributing it to their shareholders. They're not hiring very much. They're not investing very much, even though profitability is high and they've got the funds to spend. I think they really don't want to take the risk of getting involved in production. It's too messy. I think perhaps they've even basically just given up on the long-term prospects of the United States and want to make off with as much as they can as quickly as possible. They're not thinking about the long term. They can't really think about all these issues of economic sustainability, and certainly not ecological sustainability. It's just not something that a very large portion of the American ruling class has thought about very much. Climate change is going to affect everyone. You can't insulate yourself from that. Certainly, rich people are better able to insulate themselves than poor people, but they can't forever. And they're just not really thinking about this at all, much less very clearly. It's a frightening thing. I just think the American elites are detached and rotten and selfish. And in the contrast with the post-World War II ruling class, which was even during the Depression and World War II, was capable of thinking about the post-crisis landscape and planning the American empire in the midst of very dark times. That ruling class, with the ability to think for the very long term and beyond the immediate self-interest, just doesn't exist today.
Right. So major transformation is basically just this sort of short-termism instead of thinking for the long term. Is this somehow tied to some of the structural changes that you talked about the economy undergoing, and somehow they think that they won't be able to get past some of these?
Well, I think for a long while I was skeptical about the word neoliberalism. Then I was reading and thinking about it more, and I realized I was convinced that there really is something to this, and it is a very atomized, marketized view of the world. The old American WASP elite was, to some degree, some of this is hypocritical, but to some degree, was somewhat contemptuous of commerce and had a sense of stewardship. Perhaps just rhetorically, but there was some sense that they had to take care of things for the longer term. I think they have now remade the world in this neoliberal fashion, which is just really basically hyper-competitive bourgeois society, but a very hyper-competitive version of it. And what it's resulted in is a very atomized, alienated consciousness, weakening social bonds, even if among the elite, and just an inability to think beyond the immediate, and in anything beyond market terms. And I think the kind of suffering for themselves, the disease that the entire society is suffering from, which is this alienation, resignation, and an inability to think in any collective, political, serious long-term sense.
To that rosy picture, maybe I can add a question about this recent piece you just had published in Harper's Magazine, and this was arguing against Hillary Clinton's candidacy for the Democratic nomination, and then ideally for president. Maybe you could quickly sum up your argument against Hillary, and more specifically, what kind of economic interests she represents, how this would cash out, and this relationship between political and economic elites.
I think my objections here fall into three large categories. The first would be simply the dynastic, the idea of having another Clinton as president, the possibility of having another Clinton-Bush election in the fall of 2016 is just, it's depressing that we just, there's not much circulation among our elites. It's just a small gang now, it seems. We're almost getting to a hereditary aristocracy, although I guess the leading candidate to be the Prime Minister of Canada is the son of a former Prime Minister of Canada as well. But, you know, we've had an awful lot of that. We've had the two Bushes already. Now we have Hillary, and it just seems like it's a sign of a society that's gotten ossified and tired and sclerotic. The second thing is her personality, which I think is very secretive. She's devious. She's given to she doesn't like to. She doesn't like the press. She doesn't like publicity. And to have somebody who's secretive and duplicitous as president after all the increased government secrecy and repression and spying that we've seen since 9/11, the last thing we need is someone whose personality tends to reinforce those sad trends. We need somebody who's a little perhaps willing more to open things up and even just give us a little more of the old bourgeois freedoms that we used to be somewhat contemptuous of. And the third thing, though, and the most important, is her politics, which are very center Democrat. She, when I started this research, I thought that she was just sort of a passenger on the Bill Clinton Express. But in fact, as I did this research, I realized she was very, very deeply involved all along from the time they were in their 20s and first together. They've really conceived this as a joint venture. There are several sources who say that they used to talk about 8 years of Bill and then 8 years of Hill in the White House. And one of the things that they did together was almost invent the new Democrat ideology. She and Bill were really present at the creation, very active in the creation of the this very business-friendly, hawkish, tough on crime, tough on welfare, new Democrat ideology and policy. And whatever relevance that might have had in the early 1990s, I was certainly no fan of it then, but you know, you might have said it was appropriate at the time, is the last thing that the U.S. economy needs now, even by orthodox standards. We're in this midst of deep polarization, structural stagnation, climate crisis. We need a whole new way of thinking about policy. We need a much more active public sector in order to invest our way out of this, this stagnation and crisis. And she, I think, is about the last person I can think of to do it. She represents the embodiment of the status quo and the foreclosure of reformist possibilities within the Democratic Party. And you know, certainly the Republican Party is a horrible and frightening, backward and vicious thing. But center Democrats have basically
have they given in a lot?
They've legitimated and perpetuated and solidified the Reaganite transformation in the United States, and that is the problem. Obama never really broke with that, and even though he had the opportunity in 2009, I think she would just be a further continuation of these very tired sets of policies that are not really delivering much health or happiness to the population.
So cementing some of the things you've talked about on the level of sort of, you know, neoliberalism that goes out into society sort of and filters down and affects the way we see.
I mean, it's become so much the common sense of the population now that we can't even think of a different way of doing things. You know, when Thatcher said that it was not just about economics, but the point was to change the soul, she was right. She was very successful, and so has been the Reagan Revolution. We just our souls really are incapable of imagining another way of doing things.
So we've talked about the elites. Maybe now we can go down a couple notches and talk about those who have still done relatively all right, but certainly not great, the American middle class. You've mentioned them before. they seem a bit like a sitting duck, you know, squeezed by elites from the top. We hear things about automation, encroachment of crappy jobs all the time, this welfare state dropping out from under them. Is there a future for large middle class in America, one ready to prop up the economy again with its consumption and one ready to take a sort of its own politics into its hands?
It doesn't seem that way. I think the American middle class, which we're very sort of sloppy about using that term. We use it to describe households with maybe a $40,000 income, which is somewhat below average, to households, you know, with, you know, $150,000 in income. It contains, you know, what we think of as the classical working class, and then, you know, some of the professional managerial class as well, who have, you know, very different experiences of life and work. But, you know, that sense of a broad middle class was, you know, always somewhat at odds with the material reality of American life. We have actually, among the richer countries, the smallest share of the population around the median income of the major first world countries. But, you know, there's enough of a material basis to the notion of upward mobility and the possibility of getting ahead in the society that has just no longer exists. There's just no material basis for that kind of fantasy anymore. And I think people are now aware of it, but being happy is almost a national responsibility in America, and people have a hard time expressing it. And it has a hard time expressing discontent. Nobody wants to be a naysayer. Nobody wants to be a complainer. So people tend to, and this is especially true during a recession when people are unemployed for a really long time, very worried about their financial future. They were just suffered in silence. There was absolutely very little to no sense of collective action. Anything could be done about it. People just suffered in silence and threw back onto classic American self-reliance. And yeah, that middle class has a pretty gloomy present and a pretty gloomy future. And though politicians love to proclaim its virtues, they're not willing to do anything about it. You know, we're just got this constant stagnation, crappy job market. The notion that employment has become more precarious is not entirely visible in the statistics. I think people who have jobs are holding on to them for as long as they can. There's actually less job turnover now than there was 10 or 20 years ago. But you know, I think for one of the features of American life, it's always been a very brutal place, brutal competitive place. But there was a dynamism to it and a sense of the possibility and optimism. And certainly, compared to that, I have a very Central European gloomy temperament, but that's, you know, the way the average American is supposed to feel. And there was that dynamism that took the edge off the brutality of it. But now all that dynamism seems largely gone. I mean, even by just conventional measures of job turnover or business startups, it's just not happening. The rate of business startups is very low. Job turnover is very weak. It's like, you know, the American economy has lost whatever juice it had. Maybe I'm just getting old, but I think the culture has lost a lot of the juice that it used to have. And it's just, it seems torpid and rotten and polarizing and without any kind of self-consciousness or political organization or political activity or any hope of that, it seems. It's not a happy picture.
No, so maybe in slowly wrapping up, I can try to see if we can still insert any tiny maybe sparks even of hope into this quite, as you say, gloomy Central European temperament inspired picture that that you've drawn.
Now we have to import our optimism from Canada now?
Or I don't know. Yeah, perhaps. I don't know if that's one of our leading exports, though probably better than the tar sands oil. What do you think are the biggest prospects right now for any kind of any spark, any sort of renewed self-organization within society for a U.S. left or any current that can sort of put a counter to this?
Well, you know, a few years ago, I was excited by the Occupy moment. That is now, you know, more than 3 years behind us. That came as a total surprise. And for all my critiques of the lack of ideological clarity or organizational strategy, it was a moment of very lively protest that really had a tremendous effect, at least in the discursive realm of politics. It brought the whole 1% concept into mass usage and got people thinking seriously about distribution issues and power. So that was a nice moment. And if I want to feel better about things, I'll think back on Francis Fox Piven, who's a great scholar of social movements, saying that movements ebb and flow and that they work out over the course of a decade or more. And so she thinks that Occupy is one of those things, and it's just the sign of a shift that will develop over the course of a decade or so. So if I want to feel optimistic, I'll reach for that. There's also been a lot of continued protest in Ferguson, Missouri, after the police shooting of Michael Brown. That kind of protest is lasting longer than previous episodes of that, and I hope maybe there's some sign that especially poor black people in the country are tired of police repression, and there might be launching a serious and sustained resistance to that. So that's a hopeful sign. But right now, there's just not much happening that's very exciting. The labor movement is brain dead, and there's left politics is pretty marginal. There is at least a possibility that at least a portion of the population could be sparked into doing something if there were some kind of leadership or some kind of further protest developing. People in New York City, we elected Bill de Blasio mayor because he was supposed to represent a departure from plutocracy. I don't see him as representing much of a departure at all, but there is the hope that at least people are looking for something different. I've been kind of surprised by the reaction to my Hillary Clinton piece that there are a lot of people who are, a lot of liberals who might otherwise, I would have thought, would have been loyal Hillaryites, who actually expressed a great deal of skepticism and discontent about the lack of options or hoping for something else. But there's not much going on. You'd think that there are possibilities for something happening. And I would think that the possibilities are greater when we've had a modest degree of economic recovery than a few years ago, than we were in the midst of crisis. Crisis makes people scared and pull in, and improvement makes people want more. So maybe this is the time for that to happen. But it is not happening now.
Right. So just time to hunker down, wait for things to maybe get a bit of breathing room and really try to hope for something more. I'm going to have to stop it there. Thanks a lot, Doug Henwood. I hope they play some Chumbawamba or something after this. Good Lord. Thanks again.
Something lively and inspiring.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
That was Doug Henwood on politics and economics in the U.S. today. That's all for this week. I'll see you again in 2 weeks. Until then.